You're listening to Speak Free with Simon O'Connor, right here on RCR, Reality Check Radio.
Well, very pleased to have back on the show Marianne Spurtle from the Maxim Institute. I had her on a few weeks ago. We were talking schooling, particularly around the curriculum. But Marianne has now put out a new policy paper on behalf of the Maxim Institute, and this one's called Schooling in New Zealand, International Lessons for Equity and Choice. So, Marianne, welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Simon. Good to be here.
Hey, look, it's very clear from the title. This is around the choice of schools. See, I can read, which obviously is going to invoke a little bit around the whole question of charter schools, which the current government's bringing back in. But I suspect, I've read the report. It's also touching on private schools and integrated schools and so forth. But why not talk listeners through the high-level stuff that you're doing, and let's delve into it further from there.
Sure. Well, the situation in New Zealand is we do have several different models of schooling that are freely available, plus private schools and integrated schools, which have some fees attached to them sometimes. As far as our outcomes go, if you look internationally, you know, we're often bobbing around there, kind of medium or high medium, slumped a little bit over the years. What you're doing looking at the averages isn't telling the full story. If you look at the margins, you find that actually in New Zealand, we have larger gaps based on socioeconomic background, for instance, that's more closely aligned with outcomes than it is overseas. We have bigger gaps between high-performing students and low-performing students. So that's telling us that something at the tail end is not working well. The other thing I did in this is to compare the models of funding in different countries, not all countries. I specifically look at the US, Australia, and England, which all have different ways of supporting educational choice, and mention some others in other countries. And the takeaway from that is that in New Zealand, in the OECD, we're one of the countries that provides some of the least public funding for independent schools. You look overseas, in the OECD, in fact, more than half of countries fund more than half of independent schools' income. In England, half of school students go to free schools or academies, so they're independently operated, publicly funded. Australia, they subsidize, both the state and national government subsidize tuition at Catholic schools and at private schools. So you've got, 30-something percent students going to those schools, 36%. And in the US, you've got charter schools that have been operating. Sweden's got a voucher system. So there's different ways of doing it. And now we've got, obviously, charter schools coming in here probably next year. So kind of evaluated, how is that going to change the landscape here? What are the pros and cons of that?
Well, just jumping quickly, you've taken us through a number of countries that have quite a, if I've got it right, publicly funded or supported private schools. I'm cautious on my language because, of course, when we talk private schools here, we're talking sometimes differently to what overseas is thinking. But New Zealand then is primarily state schools, isn't it? Are you able to give us a bit of a percentage breakdown on what our New Zealand situation is currently?
Yeah. So about 83% of school kids here go to a state school. 11% go to state integrated schools. So right there, that's 94% that go to schools that are publicly funded, have little or no fees, have to teach the state curriculum. Integrated schools have some leeway in what they include in that. And the employment contracts with the teachers are determined by the state. So the school doesn't really have flexibility with its employment. And then what have we got? 4% are going to private schools. So those are ones where some or all of the tuition is paid for by parents or scholarships, that kind of thing. Those schools are autonomous. They can decide their own curriculum. They can decide what teachers' qualifications need to be, what they're going to pay them, that kind of thing. And then you've got about a 1% going to designated character, which is another state-funded option that's quite niche. That's a whole other conversation, and about 1% being homeschooled.
So really, and bad math on my part, but really only about 6% of New Zealand's education is, if you will, flexible, or in other words, they can decide what to teach and how to teach. The rest is pretty much mandated through the state or through the state integrated model, which, again, just to draw out what you've stated, so listeners can get it clear, is that our structure is quite different from overseas. So as you say, the likes of the UK or Australia that have a lot more flexibility in the system. And as your key argument in your report is that that structural element is actually a key component to trying to improve performance. Because I'm looking at your executive summary here. I'm just going to read it. You say more than one third of 15-year-olds struggle to read and write. 82% of Māori students leave school without UE, and more than 40% of students don't attend school regularly. So pretty shocking. So yeah, is that one of your critical points, that we need more choices in schooling to help drive improvement?
Yeah, one of the interesting things looking overseas is that there's been a trend for decades now to devolve the running of schools. As bureaucracies have got larger, a lot of countries have decentralized things. And whether it's vouchers in Sweden or charter schools in the States, or Australia providing more funding to, which ultimately what you do when you fund schools is you open up access to more students. So what that does is it narrows inequities, because students who wouldn't otherwise, and 6% you talked about, there's a huge sacrifice on the part of those families, whether it's homeschooling or private schools. And plenty more families would like, you know, they'd be willing to sacrifice something for that choice, but they literally can't afford it. So what these different countries are doing is they're simply opening up access to people who couldn't afford those choices otherwise. That's been going on for decades, but here there's a real resistance to it. And if you go back 100 years, it was pretty common. You've got your public schools, you've got your private schools. That was accepted. That's the way it's done. And it's kind of like we're still stuck in that mindset. And a lot of the rest of the world has moved on.
Look, you don't have to respond to this. This is just Simon's thinking. But I've always felt there's something quite ideological in play here as well, particularly through now former colleagues on the left who like to keep it controlled. They'd prefer actually one state system, yes, which the politicians control through their ministry, which is why I know some new integrated schools, for example. So these are Catholic and Anglican schools, had to fight tooth and nail just to open up a new school recently, because yeah, there was no desire for the state to let go of any control. So for what I think it's worth, I see a high ideological component here. But I mean, surely when we look overseas, and let's talk about the resistance we're seeing in New Zealand, the facts are clear. You know, parents are being able to give choice. There is money being made available through their taxes to that wide, if you will, panoply of schooling options, whereas here you've only got the one. So, I mean, who is the main resistors here? Is it the politicians or unions or some educationalists?
Yeah, it's very political. So the people you would expect to be opposed will be opposed no matter the outcomes. The interesting thing where it kind of reveals the political nature of it is when the partnership schools operated, this is 10, 11 years ago, the last time ACT was able to shift things up a little bit, the Maori Party was actually one of the biggest supporters. Willie Jackson was behind one of the partnership schools that opened up. And they openly said that they're doing a great job. In fact, they publicly commended Vanguard Military Academy for doing great work with Maori youth. That's a for-profit military academy, and the Maori Party looked at the results and said they're doing a great job. Now, you won't hear them saying anything positive about charter schools. I could be wrong. There could be someone come out and say, they did a great job last time. Let's expand that model wider. But I don't think you will hear any of them saying it, because this is very much split on party lines. It's ideological. So I'm looking at it from an independent kind of evidence basis. And there's really nothing concerning about having an outcomes-based approach to education, where the ministry goes, we will fund you based on outcomes, instead of saying we will fund you and tell you how to run your school, and then whatever the outcomes, you still get the funding. You know, those are the two different ways of doing it. OECD research has very explicitly said that command and control environments are on the way out. The future is about public and private partnerships. They've explicitly said that looking at international data. So this is not anything, you know, risky or groundbreaking. It's the way most countries are operating now.
Let's just pick up on that command and control side, because I used the term with you just before we came on, sort of Pyrrhic control of schools. In other words, we have these school boards, but they actually don't end up controlling a lot of their local school. The ministry sets things like curriculum, funding overall, how much teachers should be paid. And no disrespect to those who are on boards of trustees. There's some amazing people, but there are some people who are they're not up to the job. So, I mean, would it be fair to say that New Zealand system is highly command and control and it needs to devolve?
Yeah, and it's called devolve because of the individual school boards, but I haven't heard anybody on either side of the political spectrum say that they're a good thing. Everyone agrees that either they're too limited for the schools that are doing poorly. They don't have people who can really, they have the experience to be able to inform that well. And then even the ones that do, if you need some new classrooms, you can draw up the plan and make it look wonderful, but you're still relying on the Ministry of Education juggling the needs of 2,500 other campuses with yours, and you're having to gamble that by the time it gets built, they actually will have the funding that they've promised you, and they won't, you know, reduce the scope of it or pull the plug on it, which is what has happened. So, yeah, on paper, you've got autonomy within your school, but when you look at what they've got autonomy over, it's actually not things that can really move the educational dial.
No, and this is only an anecdote from my own experience. Long and short, a very well-to-do school, actually, in my area, with a very competent board and faculty. Long and short, they wanted to replan their classrooms and so forth. They did so, but they are still fighting the ministry, because the ministry in Wellington has a different set of ideas to what they've got. And it's just going backwards and forwards. And at the end of the day, only two things are happening, Marianne. One is a lot of money's been spent. And two, the kids don't have new classrooms. I suppose the other question then is, you talked about outcomes-based. And maybe I'm going to betray my political leanings here, but the unions have fought against this for as long as I can remember. They don't like testing. They don't like contrasting. I found at times they just resist. And I'm not arguing for performance pay or anything like that, but why is there resistance to outcomes? Surely, and it's one of your recommendations, testing, probably the wrong word, but testing, grading, allows us to see where the children need help, surely.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. You have to evaluate how students are progressing if you need to, you know, if you want to identify who needs more help. That's really important. The other thing, if you're talking about school choice, is people need to know which schools are actually improving outcomes if they are to have an informed choice about where to send their kids. That's just fair. School choice is a bit meaningless if you don't have that kind of data. I think some of the resistance comes from a legitimate concern that things will be shifted so that you're teaching to tests, and so that testing overtakes other important things in the classroom, and teachers who already have a burden on them from, you know, an overly loose curriculum and mandates from the Ministry of Education and student behavior, like they're already dealing with a whole bunch of stuff. And to say, and now let's roll out this new testing regime. So it's understandable why teachers' unions and many teachers and principals are wary of implementing the kind of assessment that has been done maybe not so well in the past or for the wrong reasons. I'm not an expert in assessment, so I don't know how it should be done, other than it needs to track student progression. It needs to show which teachers are doing something well so that you can replicate that within your school and between schools. It needs to be able to show when schools are doing well so that other schools can replicate what's happening. There needs to be at least enough information so that we know what success looks like. I mean, that's just fair for kids. If you take away any assessment, you know, any meaningful assessment, any meaningful comparisons, then you're just working in the dark. And you can pat yourself on the back and say you're doing a great job if you feel like you are, but the kids aren't getting what they need.
I think that's the thing I've always struggled with. I've sort of understood the argument of why we don't need testing and how all it does is drive testing-based behavior rather than learning. But even as I process that, at the end of the day, without some sort of datum point, without some understanding of progression, the only people who really suffer are the young ones. And I come back to the stats we've talked about today and prior. New Zealand kids overall are not performing well, and certainly not performing well compared to overseas jurisdictions. So I know, again, that's one of your key recommendations. And I think the government, if I'm right, is putting through some legislation to bring about this testing. Is that right?
Yeah, the details aren't there. This legislation, there are still some details that are yet to be known. It's going through very quickly without all of the information there yet. Some things were given, some things have been, you know, queued up for ages, but how the assessment is going to work is still one of those things that's a mystery. And I really hope they get it right, because if they do, then we will have a fair idea. There won't be this back and forth of, oh, they failed, no, they didn't. We need to know, is this a good idea? Is this helping kids? And then within schools, they need to know which are the children. This is not a rank and shame. This is who needs support and how can we make sure they're getting appropriate support.
Oh, 100%. And look, you've hit on a really important thing. If I could put my former career's hat on, the devil's in the detail. Politicians are very good at making announcements, standing at podiums, but then what's actually going to be built behind the statements is critically important. Can I just take a step back for a moment? Because we've referenced partnership schools or charter schools a couple of times, but I wonder if it's worth actually delving into what they exactly are. I think most people understand what a state school is. They probably understand an integrated school. They're Anglican, Catholic, Muslim, sort of usually faith-based. But what's a charter school? It's talked about a lot here. The government's bringing them back in. What are they?
Yeah, I think different people have different assumptions of what they are. I've realized in talking to people, it's very simply an independently operated school. It may be faith-based. It might be Montessori. The people I've come across who are interested in starting them up or in converting their schools to them are interested in running schools for kids with learning needs, for distance education, classical education, educating Maori boys in one context. So they are similar to integrated schools in that they're allowed their own character, or they can just be, you know, like a state school will be able to switch and become a charter school. So the whole gamut of choice, the way that they're governed, they have their own boards, or they could be part of a network of schools that's overseen by one organization. They're autonomous in that they can determine their own curriculum. They can determine who they hire, what they pay them. As far as what they're teaching and who's teaching, that has to be agreed in the charter. So the legislation is very clear that in the proposal and in the contract, the charter that gets drawn up, there is going to be a well-defined percentage of staff who must be registered teachers, and what percentage can be on a limited authority to teach. That's going to be defined. The curriculum has to be signed off. The governance has to be signed off. So they have to prove, and I think those are the learnings from last time where not all schools were prepared to open their doors with the partnership schools. These ones are going to have to be prepared to show that they can govern themselves, that they have financial oversight, and that the academic standards are at least as good as a local public school. So that's the accountability side of it. They also will have to agree to attendance levels. So, you know, if their attendance drops below a certain amount, then there will be interventions. And if schools can't meet their attendance or their, and this is the assessment is going to come into play here, or their academic outcomes, then there will be interventions. If schools don't improve, they'll lose their charter. So someone else will take them over or they will close. So that's how the accountability works with a charter school. They're going to be funded per student. If the legislation stays as it was the last time I saw it, it's going to be the same per student funding as a public school. It doesn't seem like there will be funding for property. And so schools may be able to charge a fee just for property maintenance because they're going to have to come to the table with their own property unless they are switching from a state school. The state schools that switch are going to have to maintain at least as good employment contracts with their teachers. And they get to maintain use of their properties, but they stay Crown properties. So that's kind of roughly how the legislation is shaping up.
Yeah, look, declare my bias. I'm very sympathetic to them. I've seen them at work over the last few years, some in West and South Auckland, actually, where ultimately they were giving enormous choice to a lot of families that were struggling because they provided not only the school, but uniforms, the textbooks, everything, and in a sense a charitable side almost. Granted, it's the American context. I might have raised it with you last time, but friends of ours in Minnesota who run classical education, go Latin and Greek, which I'm all for. But, I mean, there are some who will argue, Marianne, that by taking this money, government money, and giving it to a charter school rather than the state school, that's going to harm the state school system. That's certainly the argument from a number on the left or unions or those who oppose. Do you have any thoughts from your research on that?
Yeah, I mean, on paper, it's a bit of a silly argument because if you're getting per student funding, if you don't have the student and you don't have the funding for them, what have you lost? So it's a bit of a red herring as far as whether it will harm
public schools. Listeners won't be able to see this, but I am laughing behind the microphone because Marianne is just so right. There is no arguable loss. Might I just throw in there, of course, our schools are burgeoning at the moment too.
That was my next point. 20% of schools are oversubscribed. Spot on. I'm surprised that when people talk about them harming public schools, there aren't more people going, hang on a minute, don't we have news stories every week talking about how this or that school needs more classroom space? And the other problem is teachers. At the secondary school level, about a quarter of vacant positions are going unfilled. About three quarters have either one or zero applicants. Secondary schools are struggling, and in some disciplines, they're having no luck. You know, it's just almost impossible to fill some roles. So they are actually employing unqualified teachers more and more out of necessity, which is, you know, the one scary thing about charter schools. Oh, they're going to employ unqualified teachers. Well, that's happening in public schools because they don't have enough qualified teachers. More and more teachers are leaving mid-career, which doesn't bode well for the future. So if you have schools starting up that can take some students out of over subscribed schools, that's going to help the schools that are busting at the seams. That's going to help the schools that are, like the school you spoke about, trying to negotiate with the Ministry of Education to get a few more classrooms that might take away that problem from some campuses. And then with teachers, if you can recruit someone, I think that the top salary in the public school system is around $105,000. If you can offer $115,000, which some of the charter school providers who I've spoken to who would like to open them or ran them before, and I'm sure they've said the same to you, they were able to pay their teachers more than the public school rate, which is, you know, it's locked and it's fixed. If they can identify someone who they think is valuable for their school, they can adjust their budget to pay that person more. So they can recruit people who may not ever consider becoming a public school teacher because they're not willing to work for that amount. They can get paid much better elsewhere, and they're not willing to go back, spend, you know, a year studying, spend a couple years as a provisional teacher. They're not really interested in doing that, but they may be interested in what a charter school can offer them. Every time a new teacher is added to the system, that helps public schools as well because it increases the pool of teachers. So the imagined negative impact on public schools is assuming that they're all in competition, but they are not there to make money for the government. They're there to educate kids. And if somebody else can help you do that and you can focus on doing it better for those who remain, that's not a negative. That's a system working better for everyone.
Which brings me back to where we were starting, which is, again, that the results at the moment are unfortunately not good. in general. And I think you mentioned, particularly at the extremes.
I probably phrased that badly.
Bottom margin.
I mean, the averages don't tell the whole story. And it's when, you know, the PISA results and stuff, they will drill into the details and look at who is not performing well and how things are tracking over time. And when you look at that story, you realize that there are plenty of people who just do not have the choice that they should have for educating their kids. If they were given options, they wouldn't choose the one they're stuck with now.
You touch on this a little bit around choice, about the zoning question. You don't spend a lot of time on it in the report, but you talk about it. And one of your recommendations is to drop zoning. Do you want to just quickly talk us through your thinking there?
Yeah, I think it's never going to happen for political reasons, but zoning doesn't provide any educational benefit. Schools that are oversubscribed would be much better off if they could just say, look, this is our roll number. Anybody, in addition to who we've got here, who wants to get in, when we have a space available, there's a ballot system, everybody has an equal shot. And so somebody who lives in a poor suburb has an equal shot at getting into a school in a good suburb. It's not based on where you can afford to live. There'll still be some sorting because of geography, and some suburbs, you know, will always be more expensive for different reasons, but it levels the playing field. And so even though I don't think anybody in government presently will touch that, it is a good idea.
The real estate agents will be freaking out as well in some school zones, because as your report highlights, the differential is quite striking. And I know, look, there's so much in the report, and can I just really, sorry, a policy paper, and I really just want to encourage listeners to just jump onto the Maxim website. It's easy to find, maxim.org.nz, to find the paper, because there is so much to touch on. But I'd be remiss if we didn't bring up the sort of special needs or special education.
That seems
a major problem to me, and I suppose I can raise that partly personally, but it's also something I've come across a lot. Talk us through what you're seeing and what you think this policy proposals will do to improve it.
What you've seen personally is probably far more relevant than my secondhand observations, but the stats are bad. Getting ORS funding for person after person, say, it's near impossible. When kids do see improvement, they often lose the support because they've now improved. It's basically, it's not even at the bottom of a cliff. It is trying to address problems for the worst of the worst. And there are a whole lot of students who need extra support who are getting very little. The parents who I've heard talk about navigating the system are people who have every advantage navigating the system, and they found it dreadful. What that tells you is there are heaps more families who don't have the time, they don't have the money, and they possibly don't have the familiarity with the system to even get that far. And so their kids are likely to just get shunted through from year to year without having specialist support. So when people complain about access to special education, I've looked at the stats. They're dead right. There is not enough support there.
No, I mean, look, two quick observations. One thing I've observed, particularly trying to help families get ORS funding, and just so listeners understand, that's only 1% of students are able to get access to that. But the number of times, Marianne, families almost have to, for want of a better word, traumatize themselves and the child further, or exacerbate the issues the child's facing in order to get the funding is quite, well, wrong, actually, to put it into a moral context. Now, I better be clear, they're not faking what's happening, but they've really got to keep, in many ways, putting their child down. Oh, well, they've got this issue, and this is the problem with them. And it's just morally wrong. But I've never bought the argument, and please, if the research backs this up or not, the idea at the moment is that all the state schools can be all things to everyone. But intuitively, that just doesn't work, can't work.
No, it would be fantastic if it could, because that would make everything much simpler. But the reality is that it can't. And so if you're at the margins, you often will be out of luck despite good intentions and despite sometimes more funding. That is just the reality of being in a big system. And I know, I remember, went to this little private school when I was a kid out in East Auckland that my parents and some other families helped start up. And it was very much a community sees needs that aren't being met. They get together, a family subdivided their farm. And so it was, you know, on half of a farm, very much number eight wire type school. One of the families who sent their son there, sure it wasn't their first choice of school, but he had Down syndrome and he'd been told that he was never going to, you know, they'd been told he wasn't going to learn to read or write. So basically don't bother. And this community of, you know, parents who are volunteering and the odd qualified teacher, they were not going to write him off. And he was one of my classmates. He learned to read and write and do math. And so I just have this sense, aside from all the research, that if you equip communities to meet the needs that they see, they will, in a way that a system that's faceless can't do. And they may not have the same level of access to expertise and all that, but at least with the charter school model, or, you know, if it was vouchers or anything else that would have a similar impact, allow them to have access to the funding so that any child can attend, and you will find that communities answer the problems that are there.
Again, it's been my experience, which is only anecdotal. It's not research-based, but, you know, when I think of a lot of children with neurodiversity issues, behavioral issues, despite often the best intentions in state schools, it's not always, sometimes it is, but it's not always possible to give the care. And I've seen, it was during the charter or partnership school time that actually schools were able to coalesce with people with similar issues, but then teachers who, if you will, specialised or thrived in that area, and it by and large worked. And then it got broken apart, which is all quite sad.
And hey, the funny thing about that, oh, I was just going to say that the partnership school model was obviously pulled apart, as you said. But the interesting thing is those schools continue to operate and they're still publicly funded. But the opposition to them from the, you know, the typical candidates has stopped. So the schools did fine. They're continuing to do fine. They're just 9 of the 11 that were remaining are now designated character schools. And so, yeah, when you were saying this allowed schools that met certain needs, because those schools had to have, I think, 75% plus priority learners enrolled. So they were designed to meet specific needs. I know that in the days since then, there have been attempts to set up schools that specifically serve kids with learning disabilities by people with a proven track record in education, wanting to be designated character and being rejected by the Ministry of Education. So on paper, we do have a model that will allow schools with, you know, that are meeting specific needs to be publicly funded and to have a little more autonomy than your public or integrated school. And it's been the Ministry of Education saying, no, thank you, we don't need you.
Well, happy to put this on record, and it's my words, not yours, of course, but the ministry has a lot to answer for it. And maybe that's the coming in to sort of land the interview is one of your last recommendations is there's 9. We're not going to go through them all. We've touched on a few, but you're suggesting that we need to split the Ministry of Education in effect from its, my terms here, the curriculum side and the property management side, because at the moment they try to do both. Just want to quickly talk us through your recommendation and thinking around that.
Yeah, and this idea didn't originate with me. One of our senior researchers, Paul Henderson, has said this years ago, that the property management side of the Ministry of Education clashes with, you know, obviously the educational outcomes that we need. They're not actually always in line with each other. The property side should be serving the other side. But because the Ministry of Education has, I think it's the second largest social property portfolio in the country, it's a huge responsibility. And they're having to juggle the priorities of over 2,000 schools. That doesn't always serve what the kids need. And so if they merely funded, if the Ministry of Education was split into a property management arm that was just looking at the property side of things and distributing funding, and then the schools had true autonomy over what was done with that, instead of having to, you know, wait on this back and forth, funding gets carved off, it gets earmarked for the schools, there's no going back, and then the school is responsible for managing that bill, for managing the funding. I think there would be fewer clashes and it would be less political. And I include stories in the report of just how badly managed some of those projects have gone when it's been ministers at the helm who have no accountability themselves, who are not holding those making the decisions accountable. And it's just been disastrous. It should never be a political thing where somebody who's being elected can hand out treats like school property. Like, that's just going to mess things up. And it should not be the same entity that's overseeing education itself. That's just, it's silly. But again, it's not going to happen, but I think it's a good idea.
Oh, look, I'm with you. Having been inside that system, not literally the one handing out the lollies, but that's what politicians do. And it doesn't matter which team's in power, they will allocate funding at times, particularly in election years. And it's not the right way to do it. And I might add, again, it's only anecdotal. I keep saying that because you're the researcher, but I've noticed just how much time particularly principals and school boards are chewing up, focused on property, partly because they're battling the ministry or even just going backwards and forwards. And if we could free that time up for the novel idea of a school principal to focus on education, would be a great thing.
Yeah. And there are some more independent schools who actually do split that up, and the principal is only overseeing academic stuff. And then they have someone in a management role who deals with those kinds of details. I think there are a lot of principals out there who would jump at the chance to have a work situation like that.
Well, Marianne, thank you so much for giving us your time to talk through this policy paper. As I say to listeners, if you want to read it, you can jump onto the Maxim Institute website. So that's maxim.org.nz. And look for Schooling New Zealand, International Lessons for Equity and Choice. And again, Marianne, lovely to have you on the show.
Thank you so much, Simon.
From caps to tees and bags to bumper stickers, we have you covered. Visit www.realitycheck.radio/shop.